Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post his alt in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post as Amaron at dungeonsmaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week. Welcome, everybody, to D&D Encounters Season 10, Council of Spiders, Session 8, The Jay's Red Chalson. This is the final encounter of this season of D&D Encounters, and Derek and I this week are going to talk to you about what happened at our respective tables. How you doing, Derek?
I'm doing well. I'm glad that the season is over, and I'm really looking forward to next season. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about the big finale here, and we'll discuss what worked and what didn't.
All right. Personally, I guess, is my players got bogged down. They decided to sit around the start area. As I recounted last week, the priestess, which was played by myself, as well as one of my fellow table mates, long and short, the priestess,
this was the priestess that they were fighting against?
Correct, the acolyte. The acolyte. I called her the matron mother.
Yeah, I called her a priestess as well, just to keep things simpler.
Simple. So I called her the matron mother. So basically, two daughters actually walk in and see their mother making a pact with the Jay's Red Chalson, right? Big meeting and everything like that. I talked about the interaction last week. They saw their mother, both of them charged up. Well, to their demise, the party split themselves. Valen dropped his slowing zone down in the middle of the thing, and the party essentially had a lot of trouble just getting in there, period. They were almost dead.
Now, how did they... So, okay, let's back up just a minute. So, at the beginning of this week's encounter, they have the little encounter with the... How do you pronounce this? The Yolkol?
The Yolkol.
Yolkol.
Yeah.
Which is the handmaiden of Lolth, basically like an avatar. Like, it appears, it speaks on behalf of Lolth. And, I mean, if you've read any of the Salvatore novels, like, I knew immediately what this was all about because he uses them in his books. So the characters basically come down the steps. There's this altar. The handmaiden of Lolth appears and speaks to them. And it's, it says, prove yourselves to the goddess, mortals. How do you obey Loth's will? And so I explained the one group we were playing with, they had a priestess of Loth in their group. So it says, the priestesses immediately know what this represents. This either means that the party is potentially in Loth's favor, or they've done something really, really bad. So I told them, I'm like, this is your chance to justify what you're doing and why you're doing it. And I mean, I had to coach them a little bit to sort of get them on the right track and basically explain that a few weeks before, they had to decide what's their course of action. And I said, this is basically an opportunity for you to justify what you're doing and why you're doing it. However, because it's all happening telepathically, you don't necessarily have to give the answer that the group decided on verbally. If your character in your mind maybe isn't agreeing with the party and was reluctant to go along, I told them, I'm like, you have the opportunity to answer from the heart.
That's what my party,
so some of them did.
That's what my party did also. I mean, it was actually great. This gave a chance to the non-role players, the characters I've had or the players I've had a lot of trouble bringing out of their shells. It was telepathic, and I mentioned that to them, so nobody else would hear it, right? But secondly, is I finally figured out why they were so afraid of role playing, because they were afraid of giving the wrong answer or doing the wrong thing. And I finally figured it out, and it got to them, and I said, look, there is no right or wrong in D&D. I've gotten killed many a times from doing the wrong answer. I've got my whole party killed from doing the wrong thing. But that's the way it goes. So this one, actually, it clicked for all the new players at my table. It clicked, and they came out with, like, some of the most fantastic answers. And it was amazing to see. And I was, like, so happy.
Well, that's good. We, I mean, with my tables, one of the challenges I run into is we have two or three players that you know, are alpha personalities. They always want to speak first. They always want to give the best, you know, they want to hog the spotlight, but in a good way. And this can often be challenging for the newer players, especially in a situation like this. I tried to get the newer players, the players that generally don't act first, to try and respond first. That way their answer wasn't necessarily going to just be, well, I say what he said. Because I knew that the experienced players were going to give big, long, detailed, carefully structured answers.
And intimidating answers to those players.
Well, intimidating to the player as opposed to intimidating through the character. Yeah, right. Exactly. And so for a couple of the newer players, they you know, they said, yeah, okay, I'll go first and I'll try and come up with an answer. And you know, I tried to coach them a little bit and said, like, you know, you can provide more detail if you want. You can give a, you know, they don't just have to say, I'm here to fight for the Council of Spiders. It's like, well, you know, why are you here? Why do you think this is the right action based on everything you've been through? And a couple of, you know, one of the guys was just like, my character's pretty straightforward. He's a slave. He's just like, I'm here because I was ordered to be here. I'm going to do what the matron tells me. The matron said we're here for this reason, so that's why I'm here. And, you know, very short. You know, I certainly gave them the chance to give a more detailed explanation. And for the other players, they did. With my advanced group, I made them roll. Because they all basically – I knew once one guy gave a really good answer, the other guys are going to go, oh, I'm going to say what he said. So when I could – one of the players sort of whispered to me. He's like, I have something really interesting I want to try. So I made a point of saying, okay, this guy's going to go last. You guys decide who's going. It's all telepathic. Nobody understands or hears what's happening. This is all happening simultaneous. And sure enough, the other two guys just sort of basically copied each other's answers. And then the third guy was like, oh, you know, this, that, and the other. I can't remember what exactly he came up with, but he provided an answer that was very different from what the party had agreed to, but was very much in keeping with his character. And the other guys are like, oh, well, if I knew that he was going to take that approach, I would have done that. And he's like, that's why I didn't want to go first. So exactly to your point, once they realized that this was a chance for them, that none, you know, wasn't, there was no wrong answer, they were good to go. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, but it was great. It was great that, you know, at my table also, that they finally came out of their shell and they realized that they weren't going to be penalized for doing a bad thing. I mean, I can understand that you're okay, no, but mean.
No, I understand what you're saying.
What I mean is like provoking an opportunity attack when you've got one hit point left. Right?
Yeah.
People at the table say, man, you're stupid. Why did you do that? But on the other hand, when you're faced with a skill challenge or you're faced with, hey, I thought I could dive over those guys, get in to where six people are around, do my blast two power, and put them all out. Well, you know what? That's worth the risk. If you get killed, people will be like, wow, that was amazing.
That was an epic attempt. Good job. Good job trying it.
Exactly. Yeah. But these guys actually came out of their shell for that, and that's great. But some of the bonuses that you got, and you know what? I found this was really, really well written. It's actually called The Handmaiden of Lolth, right? But it was well written, better than any other non-skill challenge thing we could say.
Yeah, the week where it was all role playing, I found that week incredibly confusing, and a lot of the people on the forums commented as well that they found it incredibly confusing. And a lot of the DMs tried to create like handouts, and the DMs online tried to help each other so that we could make the encounter better, easier. I mean, for the most part, everyone I read and saw about it, they just had a lot of trouble with it. This, if it had been written like this, I think, you know, this was pretty straightforward, it was pretty simple, but I found exactly to your point. It was easy to follow. It was easy to play. The players felt that they had a pretty strong understanding once it was explained what they were supposed to do. They realized there weren't necessarily wrong answers. And then they found out after, depending on their answers, they were either received a boon or a blessing or nothing.
Or nothing, yeah. I thought it was simple. I thought it covered every single thing that happened in this whole season. And, mm-hmm. you know, in just a simple thing like, okay, let's give an example.
Most of the people in my group, they were so there's six answers. Most of them ended up being the last two, which was either I'm upholding the way of Loth by opposing ambition of the Council of Spiders, or I'm upholding Loth's command through Danafae by pursuing the spinning of the demon weave over all other concerns. And those two were the ones that provided the best bonuses. Those were probably the majority of my players landed. And so, like, with the first one, if you were upholding the way of Loth by opposing the Council of Spiders, they ended up, you know, again, there's a dialogue that accompanies it, but they got a blessing, which was 3 worth points and plus 1 bonus to attack rolls for the encounter. With the other one, where they were supporting the Demon Weave, they also got a bonus plus 3 worth points, and they got a plus 2 bonus to saving throws. So, I mean, again, it's not unbalancing. It's just enough to sort of go, hey, here's a little something for choosing path A instead of path B.
Yeah. I got one that said basically to the Yolkel, I want to eliminate all the priestesses. I think males should rock and rule. And got his negative 2 penalty to saving throws and then lost 3 worth. Guess what he finished his worth at? Negative 18.
Wow.
Yeah, he just kept beating priestesses whenever he could, secretly. Well,
and that was another thing I liked about this encounter was there's the hazardous terrain was the spider webs with spiders. If you guys go in there, they take 5 points of biting damage from the spiders. And it said, anytime a blast or burst power affects those squares, the webs are destroyed, the spiders are destroyed, but every time that happens, I think it was you lose 2 worth points for destroying the spiders. And I thought that was a nice little detail, because with one of my groups, they're not really tracking worth. They didn't care. Nobody bought the treachery cards. They weren't interested in worth. The other group, they all bought the cards. They've all been very good about tracking their worth. They're all taking actions to try and, like, screw the other guy over to play a worth card, to play a treachery card to gain all this bonus points. As soon as they found out they were going to lose worth for blowing up the spider webs, they were very, very careful about where they drop their blasts and where they drop their bursts. And even going into the spider webs, they're like, well, what if I go in and I take damage? Is that going to cause me a loss of worth? I'm like, no, just loss of hit points. You're fine. So
just loss of hit points.
Yeah.
I don't care about the hit points. Just keep my worth.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty much. So, what was an interesting encounter anyway, even when you got past the Yolklo, that, like I said, we'll get off that now, but I just thought that was fantastic. The other one I found, it was a little, You tend to disagree. You like the layout of the map and everything, but I found it was a little too. If the wrong situation happened, then basically that was it for the encounter. And I found that when Valen just dropped his zone right there and split the party in half, my party had a heck of a time just trying to get back into it.
I really like this encounter. Of all the encounters of this session, this is one of the ones that I like the most. It was very straightforward. The party had a clear goal. They were going for Valen. They were going for certain information, but they knew ultimately he's the guy. And I mean, had they been in a situation where they could have potentially dropped Valen before the rest of the monsters, I would have very, very likely had the rest of the drought surrender. But of course, that didn't happen.
It never does.
The starting placement of the creatures on the stairs, to me, in retrospect, I might have put them a little bit differently. You had all these creatures that could do immobilizing and difficult terrain. So why put those melee guys right in the front? Like, why not hold them back and let the ranged guys just shoot at characters while they're all immobilized? But anyway, I mean, if you're playing a melee character, that sucks if you get nothing to swing at. So I guess from that point of view, it's decent. But no, I like this encounter. It reminded me very much of the encounter from last season. I think it was week 3 where they were in the crypt and there was like stairs and then a landing and then more stairs and another landing. And they had a spellcaster at the bottom of the first staircase who threw a zone up in like the first round and basically trapped the party at the top of the first staircase. This is set up in much in the same way. If one of your spell spinners or Valen could get up and either drop the web burst or drop the immobilized power, potentially you could lock them down at the top of the stairs. And I know with one of my tables, we had 6 players. That's exactly what happened. And then 2 or 3 of the players managed to get freed and they ran down the stairs and basically they split themselves up, which, you know, was probably not a good idea in retrospect. But and I just had Valen and the spell spinners continue to pull back to try and keep the party separated. And I like this map, actually, if you count out the squares, it's a pretty big area. I used the whole map both times when I ran this encounter. Like, I didn't just have them bunched up at the top of the stairs and have everyone fight there. Like, once Valen realized this party could potentially destroy his group, he realized, like, there are bigger issues going on here. I'm not going to stick around and fight this party. So I made it clear that he was going to leave if the party didn't pursue him. And that way they couldn't just sit up at the top of the stairs and go, well, we're going to wait. And you can wait all you want. He's going to be gone. So No, I mean, I liked this. It was a tough encounter for both my groups, but I liked it.
It was extremely tough. I just found the Hexblades. I think there's nothing that frustrates me more as a player, and I'm looking at this going, wow, the Hexblades that just take up all the room. How do you get by them? I mean, we don't have, I guess maybe the thing is we don't have a solid controller in our group. So we have like an assassin, we have a couple strikers, we have one defender. And no, actually we've got three strikers. Basically, they're all burst powers that don't slide anything. Yeah, three strikers, a defender, and a leader, basically. So we can control anything. So pushing the Hexblade back, and I mean, I always ruled, and we always follow this rule, if you push a Hexblade back, you need at least minimum 2 squares of movement, because going upstairs is difficult terrain, right? So push, pull, or slide, I say difficult terrain. If you're trying to push upstairs, can't do it. You need 2 squares of movement, just like a regular walk. That's how I usually rule it. It's kind of a house rule.
Yeah, as long as it's consistent, I mean, you make the call and go with it. I understand what you're saying. What I ended up doing with the Hexblades was, because they have the power where they can shift the squares and get the bonus to their armor class, and if they get combat advantage, if they move, I played them as very mobile characters. Even though they were soldiers by classification rather than, say, skirmishers, to your point, I didn't want to block the party in that top group. I wanted to give the party an opportunity to come down into the room. So I had the Hexblades running around. Where we ran into a problem was the party basically won the initiative. So they had two guys run right up and fight the Hexblades. So I'm like, well, the Hexblades can't get past you. You can't get past them. So I had the Hexblades pull back into the larger room and that sort of second level. And then that way they could continue to move. And I mean, with the +4 to their armor class against opportunity attacks, that brought their armor class up to 24. For a third level adventurer, like, you need a big number to hit that. And 9 times out of 10, they missed. So the Hexblades just got more and more confident. They were constantly moving around. They were constantly getting that combat advantage. And I got to be honest. The Dark Creepers and the Dark Ones, I have a soft spot in my heart for these monsters. They're from the original Fiend Folio, which is where the Drow were originally from as well. And these are creatures I have used for years in my encounters, years and years and years. So whenever I see them in these adventures, I love using them. So, they were tough.
Yeah, they're very tough. And my characters actually really like playing against them. The only problem I had is that the Hexblades kind of stayed in the stairs like you. But I had the defender go up. Now, it's a cavalier, right? And the cavalier turned on his defender's aura.
Oh, okay. So now if they leave, they got a bigger problem.
They get 7 points of damage. So every time they shift or move, whether or not they have that bonus to AC against opportunity attacks, they're still going to take 7 damage no matter what. So you know what? Pummel them. So now they're pummeling them. They go down, and then we end up, you know, moving into the second room, but half the party's dead by then because we're all split. And, the wizard couldn't hit worth beans. He's doing his blast two, ice burst, and everything at the top of the stairs to try and get the spell spinners as well, Valen, whenever he pokes his head around the corner. And he couldn't hit worth beans. We went 3 rounds where he hit one out of the, one character out of 18 attack rolls.
Wow. Yeah, with our advanced group, the party has consisted of 2 rogues. One rogue who's now multi-class and a blackguard, and the other one's a straight-up rogue. Well, unfortunately, our full-out rogue was sick this week for the finale, so he wasn't able to be there. So our rogue blackguard was our number one striker. His dice were frigid. He rolled 2 so many times tonight. He couldn't hit anything, and it was unfortunate. I mean, we ended up – so I ran it twice. The one party that is at normal third level, they had 6 players, the encounter was tough for them. It was made tougher because the acolyte, the priestess from last week, she fled early on in the first encounter. They made no effort to stop her, and I told them, she's going to find Valen, and she's going to fight with him. So next week, you guys have an extra monster on the map, which is going to make the encounter even tougher because you let her go. And they're like, yeah, we're okay with that. So they had a really difficult time this week. It was almost a TPK. We had 4 or 5 of the 6 characters were unconscious at one point, and the last guy was bloodied. And then one of the guys rolled a 20 on his death save. Another guy managed to use a potion to revive someone else. Actually, we had a guy in our, so everyone in that group had an action point because nobody used it in the first week. One of the guys was unconscious for, I think, 3 rounds in a row near the end as the fight was getting on. And he was rolling good on his saves, but not good enough to revive. Finally, I said to him, I'm like, dude, you're the only guy at the table who hasn't spent his action point tonight. If you want to use your action point, I'll count that as a 20 on your death save. And he's like, I'm okay with that. And that way, it brought him back into the fight the next round. You know, at that point, I didn't think that was going to tip the balance one way or the other. But, I mean, I hated to see the guy sit there for 25 minutes and not be able to do anything but roll 3 death saves. No, the party, they ended up, three of them ended up dead. They failed their saves by the end. One ended up unconscious at the end of the fight, and the other two were bloodied but awake. And they took out all the monsters. They took out the spell spinners, the acolyte, the hex blades, the spiders. The only guy they couldn't take out was Valen, but he was hurt. But at that point, basically, when he had the party down to their last one or two guys, he's like, I'm out of here. Because he could tell they had it in them to come back. So he took off. So unfortunately, they didn't defeat him. I had them find the loot at the end, except for, and we'll talk about this in a second, there's three distinct pieces of we'll call it swag, that they find at the end. One of them is a scrap of paper in Valen's pouch. Valen took off. They didn't find that, but I gave them the other two. With my other party, we normally have been playing with 5. 2 of the players couldn't make it, so they only had 3 this week. But one of them was the druid, who is now level 6. We were playing up for that one. We started at level 4, so by now they're level 6. He had the ability to summon 2 creatures, and I knew that. So I didn't pull any punches, even though there were only 3 guys. He summoned his bear, he summoned his wolf, so they had 5 heroes on the board attacking every round. And again, it was very close. It could have gone either way. They ended up defeating Valen at the end. This group had a real hurt on for him. Like because these were the same characters from last season, they really wanted to kill Valen. So they were not letting him go. And so at the end, they ended up getting him down.
Sorry to interrupt. This druid that summons bears and wolves, do these creatures act independently? Are they companions? Or are they summon creatures?
It's summon creatures. And if you don't command it, it acts instinctually on the round. So as long as it's next to a bad guy, it'll attack.
Really? I always thought that you had to do a standard action to get those guys to attack. You had to give up one of your actions in order to get them to attack.
If you wanted to do something specific, attack that guy, yes. If there's only one guy next to him, it'll instinctually attack that guy. So in a couple of cases, like one case tonight, there were 3 bad guys around the one summoned creature. One of them was the minion, the spider. And the other guys at the table were like, have him attack the minion, kill it. And I'm like, no, unless you're going to take an action, I'm going to roll randomly to tell you which guy he attacks. Because it's an instinct. He's just going to attack the closest guy. They're all equally close. And the monster just appeared out of nowhere.
The guy is threatening the most, right? The guy, like, technically your die roll determines who's threatening him the most at that time.
Yeah, I'm like, basically the situation was, you know, the monster is summoned into a square that is adjacent to 3 bad guys. The monster doesn't, the summoned creature doesn't know which monster poses the biggest threat, is closest to death. It's just going to, you know, hey, here's a guy in front of me, chomp. So we rolled, and of course, he attacked the guy with the most health. So the other characters had to take out the minions. It was close for that other group as well. They ended up victorious in the end. But yeah, their rogue, oh my God, his dice were awful. He couldn't hit anything. I think he only hit once all night. I've been that guy. I've been that guy where you play the striker and you can't hit anything. Oh my God, it's so boring.
But the acolyte, I took your advice because I hadn't finished session 7 last week. So this week, as I kind of sat there and I go, we went 2 rounds into the combat of session 7 again. The acolyte, or I call her the matron mother. So
matron mother, yeah.
Matron mother. So the matron mother's sitting there going, hi, I'm feeding off my own minions to heal myself. She's doing basically a ballet dance in the middle of combat. Nobody's attacking her. So I spent literally 2 rounds just getting her to kind of pew-pew, walk away. Pew-pew, walk away. And basically wave to the party as she's going by. She goes, I'm going to see Valen now, so follow me if you dare. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Taunting them.
And the party's just not doing anything. So I said, you know what? Just for that, you guys are going to learn the hard way. And, yeah, they learn the hard way.
Well, one of the tactics that I use tonight that I use quite often.
Stop, drop, and roll?
Well, that too. normally, every monster at heroic tier has 1 healing surge. However, They can't use their healing surge unless it's triggered. So in most cases, they don't have that ability. However, a heal check on an adjacent ally can trigger a second wind, which lets them use a healing surge. DC 15. So often what I will do is have monsters that otherwise couldn't contribute to the attack that round. Maybe they don't have line of sight. Maybe they're an immobilized melee guy. Who knows? And I'll have the wounded character go up next to them on his turn so that on that other guy's turn, he spends a standard action, makes a heal check. Boom. Suddenly that guy's got hit points back. So that's what I did. Given the way that this map is set up with the party at the top of the first staircase, once the Hexblades got a little bit wounded, I had them pull back. And, you know, I had characters. I had the other Spell Spinner or Valen, or for the one group, I had the Priestess off in the background. And, you know, they weren't. I didn't have any good reason to have those other monsters come in and join the fight at that point. So I'm just like, yeah, they're gonna spend their standard action making heal checks on these, you know, the grunts. And my players even commented, they're like, wow, these guys really seem to have a lot of hit points. And I told them after, I'm like, well, this is what I did. This is why it was tougher. You guys, you know, you let them get away, and they patched them up and sent them back into the combat. And they're like, oh, hey, that's not fair. And I was like, you guys can do it to each other.
Well, yeah, one thing I found fair. I don't necessarily take your action with the monster and the healing surge and everything like that. Good thing. What I do is when I see monsters, when I'm doing organized play like this, and I see monsters that have the matron, mother, priestess, cleric, whatever, that kind of thing, I think, first of all, I think healing word. So yeah. I let them do healing word. I get it. I give an extra d6. Unless the creature has a specific power that allows them to heal other creatures, I tend to give them, oh, you get one healing word per encounter, right? I do something similar to that, to what you do, yeah. But I kind of give them that power.
Well, I mean, I think it's like anything else. The adventure is printed, but it's really a guide. You as the DM need to gauge the party and the situation and decide when to make these changes. Right. And I mean, especially I played a season of Encounters a few seasons back where we had 5 strikers and a leader. I doubled, sometimes tripled the hit points of the monsters just to give the party a challenge. Otherwise, the encounter was over in one round. And I mean, that's certainly not balanced, but it's what was necessary in order to give this party a challenge. And I think your point about the healing is bang on the money. If you've got a party that can deal heavy damage, and you know, it's only the first round. Like, you got to find a way to keep them going, to keep them challenged.
Especially when
we sort of diverge here. We're off on a little tangent.
No digress this week. Nice.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry, I did mention it.
Yes, you did. So so like I said, with my two groups, one of them, the group that was playing up that knew Valen from last season, they finally got him. They interrogated him. He wouldn't reveal information, and then they made him suffer a slow, painful death. And they reminded him of all the troubles they had to go through last season, and then they got the rewards at the end. The other party, Valen took off. They killed everybody else during the combat, so they didn't have anyone to talk to. But they did find some of the information that was presented at the end of the adventure. The biggest complaint that we had, like, people liked this encounter, but they felt that, again, the end of the adventure seemed kind of flat. It's like, okay, well, now what? I'm like, oh, so I read them the little conclusion blurb, and they're like, oh, that's it? Like, nobody really seemed to feel that it was a very satisfying ending.
I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it from the point of view of the DM reading the story, but I don't know. I just, especially because there was no reward at the end. Like, it's, you know, the old typical adventure. You're hired to do this job, and at the end, you come back and you get your loot or your magic, whatever. And like with this last couple of seasons, it's just, you know, oh, well, you know, you've done what you were asked to do. Good job. It's like, that's it. I don't know. It just seemed to fall a little flat, in my opinion, for the end of the season.
Web of the Spider Queen, I found, was pretty good. I mean, they go back to the inn, big celebration. Kind of reminds me of Star Wars. I see, you know what? I see a lot of stuff in these adventures when they're created. I see a lot of, what do you call that? Fiction, fantasy? Pop culture references. Like, come on, at the end you have all the heroes are sitting there at the bar, and I'm just picturing like R2-D3 or something like that. Like, you know, some sort of druidic treant or something like that sitting beside the big hulking gnoll going, you know, whatever. Anyway, but there's a lot of reference. And yes, this, the one thing that made the adventure, they gave it a good conclusion was a Handmaiden of Loth. I'll come back to it. Yes,
yes.
I'll come back to it. That actually made this whole session. But you're right. At the end, there's nothing that says, well, what do you have? So basically, you sit there with those three pieces of information in your hand, and you're done.
Yeah, it almost would have been – I almost would have liked it better if that handmaiden maybe would have reappeared, or a priestess would have come at the end. Some other thing just to sort of put a nice little bow on it. It's like, you know, this is what happened. You've earned Loth's favor, or, you know, maybe not even Loth's favor. Maybe some important benefactor, you know, someone from a higher up house comes and says, you've done the city a great service. I'm going to take credit for it because – I need this political clout, and as a result, I'm going to grant all you guys a favor if you keep your mouth shut. You know, like something drow. I wanted a drow ending, something that would signify that, you know, there's politicking and backstabbing and scheming. Like, the end didn't seem to have anything of that nature tied to it. I mean, it was certainly implied based on, you know, the setup for these last two encounters, but I wanted it spoon-fed to me a little bit more.
Kind of like more like, if the characters capture Valen Jailray, this is what happens. A high priestess of whatever comes over, wants that, like you said, political clout. Let's sacrifice him. Or if you kill him, then this happens. Or if you don't kill him, well, then Jarlaxle is contacted from the Brigand Aerith. And, you know, I know what you mean. You need a good conclusion to a story. And I mean, it's not like it even continues in the next session anyway. In the next season.
It's just a couple of sentences here. It says, the death of Valen Jailray is a step towards averting a civil war that threatens to engulf Menzo Barranzen. Okay, that's all well and good. How did that happen? Like, don't get me wrong. I don't want to waste 2 hours role-playing it out. I mean, if this was a home campaign, I absolutely would. But for encounters, I don't want a long, drawn-out, this is what happens. But I mean, I would have liked another column of text just to explain, this is what happened. Or give the PC some options. You know, you've had options all the way along. You can choose to go with this group. You can choose to go with that group. Like, give them some options at the end. What do? You can do this. You can stick around and join this group. You can take the loot and leave. You can sell it to the highest bidder. You can take this information. Like, they've said all along, information is power. What do you do with this information? How can you benefit this character? Like, give me a conclusion to what this character did. I've developed them over 8 weeks now. Where do I think these characters go after this story? And right now, I have nothing to go with. Again, not that I'm ever going to play these characters again, but, you know, it just seems like the loop didn't completely come full circle at the end for me, and that was a little bit of a problem.
I think that's the your unsatisfied part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So overall, what do you rate it? Well, I guess we can talk about it. We've got...
Yeah, I don't know. I'm honestly going to do a big blog post next week, as I always do at the end on Dungeons Master. I do a big report card where I talk about, you know, I break it into three sections, good, bad, and ugly.
Are we going to talk about that next week?
Sure, if we want, we can do a season wrap up at the end.
Or are we doing something else?
Well, we'll see how things play out. Let's finish this week's first.
All right, sounds good. Okay, anything else to add?
No, like I think we mentioned earlier, the party finds some stuff. I don't even think it's really pertinent to get into it. And because it doesn't really say what they do with it, it's just you find this stuff, rah-rah.
I think what they're trying to do, though, also, is I look at this, right, and I totally agree with you. I think no satisfying conclusion, but I mean, I think what they're trying to do is get people to take their characters and continue it. And maybe it'll give incentive for these new players to form groups. Or do something along those lines, and you can continue on from there. But the thing is that, once again, is the references are so ingrained in the literature that surrounds the drow that these new people who aren't new to D&D would have to read all the Salvatore books, would have to read all the other stuff. And that itself is, I know nothing about War of the Spider Queen. So these characters are going to be coming in, forming this new group, have no idea what to do from there. It's just kind of like, it almost seems like it's over the newbie's head.
No, but I think maybe you hit the nail on the head. I think that maybe the idea is that the people that put the encounters together, they want you to now finish the story in your home game. And if that's the case, then I think that that's, you know, it's pointing us in that direction. But I think they needed to spoon feed it a little more. I think we needed two or three sentences at the end that said, where do we go from here? You know, leave it open-ended. Note to DMs. Where do you go from here? Suggest that the players take these characters, with this background you've now created as part of a shared storytelling experience over 8 weeks and introduce it to your home campaign. If you've got the Menzo Brands and City of Intrigue, rock on. Go ahead. Here's a whole, there's, you know, and then maybe make a couple of suggested ideas. You know, alternatively, maybe they choose to leave Menzo Brands in and explore the Underdark. And then you know, again, it's a good way to give a plug to a couple of the new books. You say, pick up the Dungeoneer Survival book and, you know, have a little Underdark campaign. And it's like, okay, well, you know, away you go. But if that is indeed the expectation, I think they needed to be more clear of that, because that never occurred to me until you just mentioned it.
While all the infighting and while Valen is scheming and while the rest of the Drow are scheming, the Illithids come in, grab the demon weave, take off. End of story.
Actually, you just reminded me with infighting. Now, it doesn't sound like any of the groups that we played with, that none of the characters actually came to blows, but I'm actually kind of curious to find out, and I guess we'll find out from people who comment on our blogs and from reading the forums, how many parties at the end fought each other. Like, because potentially you could have had representation from these three groups, and, you know, by the end of it, they may not have all agreed. You might have had the House Salorn group, the Brigadaerith group, and the House Malarn group. Like, by the end of it, especially if the party's already wounded, if you've got one guy who's in a position of power and he's like, you know what, this is my chance to take power. I'm the only guy at this table from House Salorn. I'm killing you all before you can take your rest. I'm slitting throats and stealing the loot and taking the power. I'm kind of looking forward to hearing stories where that happened, because I guarantee there are groups where that happened. And I mean, that's not typical D&D behavior, but since a lot of people are going to look at these characters as throwaways, I see that as a potentially very interesting way to end the season. And I'm looking forward to hearing how some people actually went down that path.
Yeah, that'd be kind of neat. Hopefully people can comment. Hopefully we can get a couple of people that read our blogs to, that where it has happened to them. So yeah, very good. So, well, out of time as usual. Time just passes so quickly. This concludes session 8, Jay's Red Charleston, and concludes Council of Spiders season 10 of D&D Encounters. We would like to thank everyone who listens to and supports our podcast. It really is appreciated. Follow us for season 2 of Recounting Encounters, coming soon.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit DungeonsMaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D Encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at @20Foot, and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D Encounters. That's 20footradius, 20ft, radius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.